December 10th is Human Rights Day. This Saturday also marks the 40th anniversary of the day the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Amnesty International is a human rights group whose work is based on the principles of the Declaration. Amnesty works to stop the torture and execution of all prisoners and campaigns to release prisoners of conscience. It also monitors human rights violations around the world. My guest Jack Healy has served as the executive director of the U.S. branch of Amnesty since 1981. Healy initiated a series of benefit rock concerts to raise consciousness about human rights violations. This fall, he led an international concert tour that featured Bruce Springsteen, Sting, Peter Gabriel, and Tracy Chapman, and made stops in the U.S., Canada, Tokyo, Zimbabwe, the Ivory Coast, Brazil, and Argentina. Under Healy's leadership, the American branch has grown from 40,000 to 300,000 members. I spoke with Healy about his efforts to use show business on behalf of human rights, but I asked him first to describe the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the document whose anniversary will be celebrated this weekend.
40 years ago, you know, after what the Nazis did to Europe, the world got together and drew up a document to try and prohibit that ever repeating itself. And in the Declaration of Human Rights, is set a vision on how governments really ought to be treating their people. And given 40 years later, one-third of the governments are torturing every day with systemic state machinery. And half the governments in the UN have political prisoners in them. We haven't gotten very far. And so what we wanted to do was highlight just the 40th anniversary and restore a sense of hope to it.
How does Amnesty International use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Well, we took from the Declaration of Human Rights four main points: the political imprisonment, torture, and executions, and a fair trial if you're picked up by government. We stick to those, but we took them from the Declaration, and the Declaration is a much broader document. But we thought in its 40th anniversary that, given that Amnesty is an international body and the UN and all that, we thought we'd celebrate the 40th anniversary in a way that would put a constituency behind the document.
Amnesty International works, among other things, to free prisoners of conscience. Now, how do you define a prisoner of conscience?
Prisoner of conscience is someone who's never used or advocated violence and is in jail for their race, color, creed, or ethnicity. They're normal, average, decent people who just shouldn't be in jail. They never did anything. They just shouldn't be there.
Because of that clause that says a prisoner of conscience is someone who hasn't used or advocated violence, are there any people who you'd like to support but you can't because they were revolutionaries and did use or advocate violence?
Well, certainly Nelson Mandela would be one, but he's used in that, you know, he's advocated violence in the struggle against apartheid. But we adopt his wife, Winnie, who has never used or advocated violence. When she goes to jail, she becomes a prisoner of conscience, and that's the difference. It's one who uses and one that doesn't use violence.
One of the techniques that Amnesty uses is to try to shame governments into stopping torture or releasing prisoners of conscience. And it always shocks me that a government that can sanction torture can somehow be shamed by the public knowledge of it.
A government is a lot like a personality. It seeks endorsement and wants to avoid criticism. And so what we do is whack them as hard as we can when they have human rights abuse. And they feel it, and at times they respond. Times they don't, of course.
You use a lot of letter writing. You encourage the members of Amnesty International to send letters to who the prisons where the prisoners of conscience are held. To whom are the letters addressed?
Well, to sometimes the prison official, the presidents, minister of justice, the prisoners themselves, the family of the prisoners. We use any clever, nonviolent means we can to get someone out of jail.
What does a typical letter say?
It respects the government and asks for the release of that prisoner. We know where they are, what prison they're in, and that they haven't done anything wrong. And we ask the government to let them out.
If a government or a prison gets, say, hundreds of letters on behalf of a prisoner of conscience, how does that affect them? I guess if they know that it's an organized campaign, a campaign organized by Amnesty International, does that make it more powerful or less powerful?
I think the technique,
yeah.
From the prisoners that we have been released, prisoners of conscience, it seems like it's powerful. The evidence is that like one prisoner in the Republic of South Africa said on the first 50 letters, I got into a better cell. The next 50 letters came, I got some clothes. The next 50 letters, I got some food. And eventually, I became a leader in the prison due to the letters that were coming in. What it also does is alert the torturer and the executioner that we know that they're there doing their dirty business, and that public light stops them at times.
How do you know? How do you find out who is in jail and who is being tortured, since that is frequently kept a secret even from the family of the people who are imprisoned?
We have about 250 people in London, our international secretariat, that monitor the world on a daily basis, a minute-by-minute basis. And their job is to monitor the world, get the information out to the world, into to us sections around the world. The U.S. is one of 44 sections around the world.
What is the history of the letter-writing technique? How was that technique first developed?
It was our founder, Benenson, who was angry when he heard about two Portuguese kids who got 6 years in jail for toasting to freedom in a bar in Portugal. He wrote a letter that got published in Le Monde, and the response was so incredible that it essentially began Amnesty International. So we were letter writing from Jump Street, really.
My guest is Jack Healy, and he's the executive director of Amnesty International in the USA. You've developed a new kind of consciousness-raising for Amnesty International, and that is the Rock benefit. In 1986, you did a six-city tour of the United States of rock concerts for consciousness-raising, and you followed that up this past fall with a series of concerts that took you to several continents. Bruce Springsteen and Sting, Peter Gabriel were some of the performers who participated. What gave you the idea of doing these rock concerts for consciousness raising?
Oh, I had it, golly, 1971, I tried to do a tour of the United States with the Raspberries from Cleveland. I always wanted to do it, really. And I never could really get it done. I tried it with Dick Gregory's World Hunger Run in 1976 with Stevie Wonder. It didn't work out. And I just kept coming. When I come back from Africa as a Peace Corps director to become director of Amnesty, I went to Bill Graham right away and said, "Bill, I'd like to try this. I think there's a take here." And then eventually he said, "Well, you get the talent, I'll do it." And eventually I talked to you too, and they joined us, and that's how we started the Conspiracy of Hope. The second one really is like an effort to celebrate the Declaration. I thought the only way to celebrate the Declaration of Human Rights is to do it truly around the world. And that's how that tour came to be.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn any lessons from Live Aid, which was also a really big rock consciousness-raising event, about what worked and what didn't?
Oh, yeah. To keep your message clear and pure and tough, and not to give in to any censorship or... to really like make your message eminently clear and acceptable in the sense of making it totally clear that you can accept or reject the message and not fuzz it in any way.
One of the criticisms that was leveled at Live Aid is that it risked in the television broadcasts becoming a self-righteous commercial for the corporate sponsors of the concert. What kind of considerations did you have about what kind of corporate sponsor you'd want to use for your event so that you had financial backing, but it didn't become just a commercial for the sponsor?
Well, we went to great lengths with the Reebok Corporation to do an underwriting, not a sponsorship. We wouldn't have it at the back of the stage. We wouldn't guarantee anybody wear clothes or shoes. We took out all of that, and they did a gentle underwriting, I call it, and it really was like their lawyer told us this is the worst contract he's ever seen because it guaranteed them nothing, and that's exactly what we wanted, except an association. We did not want a corporate overlay to human rights or to Amnesty or to... And so we set up a Concerts for Human Rights, which is a different IRS number from Amnesty, and that's how we did it, to keep that independence and freedom which we need in the human rights movement.
Did you check out the potential corporate underwriters for their political background and to see what their operations were like so that you wouldn't be doing business with someone who was in their own way cooperating with the kind of repression that you were working against?
Yeah, in fact, we got certified letters from good groups like the Corporate for Corporate Responsibility. We got a letter certified from them saying they didn't have any South African holdings. And we looked at their contracts in South Korea and Taiwan. Yeah, we went to great lengths and we checked with a lot of people and got certified letters from them that they were clean.
When you started doing these rock concerts, were you listening at the time to a lot of rock music, and were you up to date on who all the really popular bands were?
No, I'd never heard of you two. I'd heard of Jackson Brown, I guess, but no, I really am not a rocker. I like music, but I'm not really a rocker, no.
So what did you do for a crash course so that you'd know who to approach?
I crashed. When you're dealing with Bill Graham and managers, you do crash. It's a hard world to work in. I do my best. I don't always do the right things, but we got the job done twice, Conspiracy Hope and the Human Rights Now tour. And it's rough. It's hard work. There's a lot of conflicting interest, and it's hard to bring it all together.
Well, there must have been times when you met some superstar rock performer whose work you weren't really familiar with, and they, on the other hand, probably also didn't know much about Amnesty International until you really talked to each other for a while. Did that happen?
Yeah, a whole lot. But, you know, the British groups and the Irish groups know about Amnesty, and they really, you know, Sting and Peter Gabriel have been with Amnesty as long as I have been, mm-hmm. as a donor or as an activist. But U2 is already members of the Irish section. So some of them, yeah, but it was more Americans. They really had to have their consciousness raised. They really don't know about human rights, and so it took some time. Jackson Brown, though, and Joan Baez, of course, have been with us for years and years and years, mm-hmm. and so it was nice to have them.
Rock stars are notorious for being spoiled and catered to. When they travel in luxury. Backstage, they expect champagne and specially prepared foods, and they make all kinds of demands on the promoters and on the people who are holding the concert. Did you talk to the bands beforehand and tell them to keep that kind of stuff at a minimum during the tour for Human Rights?
Yeah, I told them we were going to be Spartan, that was it, and there was no argument about that, and they agreed to that readily, though. I mean, the bands we had with us are just incredibly good people, and it doesn't take much convincing either. I mean, the managers are very much with us on that type of thing. In fact, they're tougher on finances than we would be, because, you know, we don't know rock and roll and how much a stadium costs. They're very helpful to all that. And they want as much to come to Amnesty as possible.
Were there countries that you wanted to take the concert to but had a hard time getting into?
Well, first, we never thought we'd get into the Eastern Bloc. We wanted to. We never thought we would. We got into Hungary and really mm-hmm. wondered. We're pleased about that. We wanted to play in the Soviet Union. We never got there. We'd like to try China, too, but we didn't get there either. We'd like to play in those two large population bases, because they, too, are signatures to the Declaration of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, this must have been a new experience for you, because you, I think, at most of the concerts addressed the crowd before the concert began. Is that right?
Did I address them?
Yeah.
A number of them, yeah. Yeah. I did, sure.
Well, it's a really big crowd to talk to.
Yeah, about 90,000 in most of them.
It's hard to keep the attention of 90,000 people, and I have to say, I think especially so at a rock concert where people are notoriously impatient until their favorite singer comes on. I mean, they're even rude to, very rude sometimes to opening acts. Did you ever have to quiet an impatient crowd in order to get them to listen to you?
We never really had that problem. I mean, we played in a hurricane in Costa Rica, and the kids were standing in 6 inches of mud that they didn't move. No, we never had that problem. We had the opposite problem of so many people trying to get into the stadium. No, we had never had that problem.
But I meant like while you were talking, of people in the audience talking.
Well, I mean, they carry on as normal concert goers, but I think they have an extra devotion to human rights. I mean, you know, I think there is a bit of concert fatigue in UK and the United States. There is not concert fatigue in Costa Rica, Zimbabwe, Ivory Coast, India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're anxious to see you and they love you. And, you know, you take disappearances, for instance. It doesn't mean much. That word doesn't mean much to Americans. But to Latin Americans, it means incredible pain level. Everybody knows someone has been killed, tortured. It means something when you go down there and sing about disappearances when Sting sings They Dance Alone. They emotionally get caught up in it. They're with us. It's like one big happy celebration, everybody crying and weeping because they know what disappearances mean.
What do you think the gains were finally for Amnesty International by taking these concert tours around the world?
Well, we hope all around the world there'll be a backdrop where there might become more domestic human rights groups, monitoring groups, authentic groups. We hope we have more members in Amnesty, especially in the third world. We want to grow there. And I think in the West what we needed, it's not seen as like we're seen as popular and all that, but we really do need growth in the United States as well as Spain, Italy, UK. You know, one-third of the governments are torturing every day. How are we going to stop them? We got to get stronger.
Was this controversial at all within Amnesty International? Did you get any criticisms from within your group for mixing show business and human rights?
Amnesty is a wonderful democracy, so everything is controversial. And we love democracy and we love dissent, you know. I mean, we're usually for the people carrying signs, even if it's against us. No, sure, we had a lot. And, you know, a lot of people said this is frivolous. But we think the results will prove will be okay. And certainly the dissidents of thought, I have it too. You know, I worry about the results as well. We all have that, and we're glad to have the dissidents and argue and back and forth. But overall, I think our first experience with the Conspiracy Hope was it was good. We were a post-40 organization until the Conspiracy Hope. We now have young people with us. We have 1,000 high schools with us, for instance. Those young kids work like dogs. I mean, they produce 5,000-10,000 signatures on a petition. It's great. And when they come to our meetings, they're part of our movement. It's really terrific.
You said there are, however, some things that you do worry about this mix of show business and human rights. When you do worry, what are the things that you think about?
Any corporate underwriting. I wish I could have done it without them.
Mm-hmm.
But given that we did it, Reebok was good and it worked. I worry about that rock and roll is seen as frivolous and stupid, and there's no connection between the two, that the people come to the concert just come to hear music, and the other side of it, they don't turn into human rights activists. If they don't, then the concert hasn't worked. I think we worry about bringing Western values to the third world and being seen that way. But it didn't work that way because mm-hmm. they really welcomed us in it, so mm-hmm. we were pleased about it. But we were deeply worried about that. We worried we couldn't play an Eastern Bloc, but be seen as a Western celebration,
uh-huh.
not a universal declaration. And we worried about ethnicity on the stage, so we had a local band, national local band, everywhere we went. You worry about all types of things like that, getting through borders. Can you play where people really don't like you? And we were able to.
Let me ask you about one other worry. Do you ever worry about why we need celebrities to get people to think about certain issues?
Well, I'll tell you, when the nonviolent are in the struggle with the violent, I on the nonviolent side will use any means
mm-hmm.
I can.
Mm-hmm.
And if that takes, you know, all types of foolishness and silliness, I'll do it if, in fact, the result is that the nonviolent can stop the violent, especially these governments who are killing and torturing people every day with no accounting to anybody. They need to be faced off. They need to be someone in their face. They need someone pressuring them, embarrassing them. I want to chase them. I just want to chase them.
Do you think you'll do this again, this kind of concert tour?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't want to become a rock and roller. I'm not a promoter. I'm a human rights activist, and whatever will move our movement in the direction of stopping governments from killing and torturing people, I'll do it. But it's not planned that I don't want to get into that mode.
Okay. Well, I want to talk with you more about your human rights work, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jack Healy, the executive director of Amnesty International USA. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Jack Healy, is the executive director of Amnesty International USA. Amnesty seeks the release of prisoners of conscience and fair and prompt trials for all political prisoners. The group opposes torture and executions. Amnesty tries to uphold the rights proclaimed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is adopted by the UN General Assembly 40 years ago this Saturday. Jack Healy, I'm interested a little bit in your life and how you came to work for human rights. I know in the late 60s you were a Catholic priest, and I was wondering why you first entered the seminary.
Oh, I sort of was a mischievous kid, and, you know, a young priest came to me and said, I'm better than that, and I should do something better with my life, and he talked me into it, and I went and tried it, and I liked it. Franciscan tradition is a good tradition. It's a peaceful tradition. It's one that respects the nature, life, and it was a good one. And I'm glad I grew up that way.
What kind of work were you doing as a priest?
I did civil rights work, anti-war work, homeless, soup lines. I'm a devotee of Dorothy Day. Jim Groppi of Milwaukee was a good friend of mine. Those kinds of people, Fannie Lou Hamer.
Mm-hmm.
I love them.
Why did you decide to re-enter the secular world?
I essentially, that world was too small for me. You know, we're going to bed at 9 o'clock at night, and the world was too small. That was too small for me. I just had too bored. You know, I had to get going. I had to see the world, do something in the world, and it didn't offer me that opportunity. Eventually,
did you stay committed to the faith after leaving the priesthood?
Yeah, reasonably. I would say reasonable. I wouldn't go claiming I'm great at it, but I'm deeply devoted to religious belief, though. belief in God. Yeah.
Did you go a little bit wild after you left?
No, I didn't know how to. No, I've been in Franciscan so long. It takes a while to get those shackles off. But I guess some people accuse me of that. But I have a lot of energy, and I've always had it, luckily. And I guess a lot of people would see I went wild, but I don't think so. No.
Now, I think the place where you were first introduced to Amnesty International was in Lesotho, in Africa, where you were director of the Peace Corps in Lesotho. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I'd been a donor for years, small donor, you know, $10, $15. I don't have much money, but I gave when I could. And then I was in Lesotho, and that's when human rights came to me. They were killing essentially the Protestants. The Catholic government was killing Protestants, and it was really upsetting. I went to the prisons, and I knew the prisoners coming out of South Africa. I got to know them well. Got to know the ANCs, the PAC. I got to know everything about Southern Africa as a layman could. And I just decided I got to do something about all these things. I don't know what. And then I got a mailing from Amnesty, which I'd been trying to get one for years. I never got one. Somehow this one reached me, and then had the NAD for executive director. I answered it.
And that's how you got the job?
Yeah, I didn't know anybody or anything.
You know, it seems to me in your position as the director of Amnesty International that you're really exposed to the best and the worst of human nature. You see people sacrificing their lives for social justice. On the other hand, you see people torturing these people. So you're really exposed to the best and the worst. And I was wondering if there was a war going inside you between optimism and pessimism about the human spirit.
Yeah, sure. You go through that all the time. You also go through... You know, a victim of torture tells you again how they've been tortured. It's horrendous. I mean, you really... But on the other hand, you got to get your inspiration from somewhere. And the victims of torture, families of the disappeared, of the executed, are my inspiration, without question. They give me drive and vigor, and most of my support comes from there. I'm a bit crazy, and they like that. I mean, they want someone, you know, hell-bent on getting something done, and that's what I try to do.
Can you tell the story of one of your successes that continues to inspire you and to help you believe that there are results to the work?
Yeah, it's people who survive torture, and you know they go through their whole life, and it comes back to them like a demon in the night, and they got to deal with it practically daily or every other day. And I know them, and I watch their struggle to keep their sanity, not to kill themselves, not to. You know, to live in spite of the damage that's been done to them. And the power that they bring to their life just to survive and be a normal human being is very inspiring to me. And I know a lot of them, and I love them for it. And it does a lot for me. It makes my life seem insignificant and my problems insignificant because I don't have that kind of thing to deal with.
It's important, I guess, to meet the individuals who have been freed so that your work at Amnesty doesn't become thinking about a lot of statistics, but rather about actual people.
I think that's how our whole movement feels. It deals with a single prisoner. It sets up a relationship with a single prisoner. And that's the glory of Amnesty, really, and the power of it. We deal between one average, normal, decent person and the imprisoned average, normal, decent person. That relationship makes it go.
Amnesty International makes a point that it's a humanitarian group and not a political group.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder where and why you draw that line.
Because we got to be credible with governments to influence them, and so we have to be pragmatic. And what we want to do is free prisoners, stop torture and executions, give fair trials for people. That's our goal. So we're pragmatic about that. And in order to do that, you got to do that with balance and partiality. The day you joined a lefty or a righty, you'd be gone. The left would never deal with you again. The right would, you know, eventually would see that you're just unprincipled, and they'd drop you too. What you need is someone out there who just doesn't want the endorsement of either one and just does their work and sticks to the human rights abuses of government, doesn't attack the government, but attacks the human rights abuses. That's what we try to do.
Would it be asking you to step outside of your role to comment on Gorbachev's comments?
No. Any progress in human rights is terrific. And if he fulfills his promises, you know, that's terrific. That's encouraging the human rights movement. And if the two superpowers of the world lead in morality and decency, it certainly would improve this world of ours. In fact, he and Reagan or Bush could remove torture the way they remove missiles. It's doable, just like that.
Is there a particular case of special interest to you now, a particular political prisoner of conscience?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, we always have them, and we always work, you know, with them. We had one Maskey on the tour that Sting talked about, and he got out right after the tour. I think overall, you know, in campaigns, what we try to do is take any group of people, any community, the government is trying to turn into lesser people and give them a name so they can torture and kill them. We rally to them. We watch that no one becomes a lesser person in this world. And so one day it could be the Kurds, next day the Palestinians, the next day the Green Irish, the next day the Orange, the Sunni in a Shiite country, a Shiite in a Sunni country, Malay in a Chinese. You have to watch the underdog, the minority, the people they're trying to make less, and you protect them. By protecting everybody, you protect all of us. When you fail anybody, you fail the whole thing.
Can you pass on the comments that anybody has made to you after getting released from jail, in part because of a letter-writing campaign? Have you had that opportunity to hear people directly address that?
Yeah, it humbles you. It really humbles you. Simon Farisani, South African minister, Lutheran minister from Venda, in the north of Republic of South Africa, says he's alive because of amnesty. Veronica De Negri says she's alive because of the hope we gave her after she was tortured in Chile, and then when her son was torched by the Chilean police. She felt solidarity with Amnesty and other human rights groups and make her feel alive. Juan Mendez of the America's Watch is a victim of torture. He says he's alive because of the hope he gets off people, like the human rights people in Amnesty. There's really hundreds of thousands of them. The Soviets, prisoners who've come out historically over the years felt that even though sometimes we didn't get them out of the gulag, if they were reached by a letter and someone remembered they were alive, that they weren't forgotten, that someone knew they had a wife and a kid, that this restored hope to the prison and they could last longer. These are all humbling things.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your work in human rights. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Jack Healy. He's the executive director of Amnesty International USA. And this Saturday is Human Rights Day. It marks the 40th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 10th, 1948. And by the way, this Saturday evening, HBO will present a documentary of Amnesty's Human Rights Now concert tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.